Welcome to Living with Dying, a podcast where we're going to talk about the unspeakable, everything to do with death and dying, and how to live with it. Well, I'm joined on today's podcast by Catherine Gilbert, who's nurse consultant at the hospice. And we're going to tackle the tricky subject of dying itself. It seems to me that if we're going to be talking openly about death and dying, we really need to talk about dying itself. And we don't normally do that. We shy away from it. It's like it's a taboo. And I guess that's because we're mostly a bit fearful about what it might be like for us and for our nearest and dearest. So today, Catherine, I hope you'll help me demystify what death and dying can be like. And shall we begin by you talking about the most common symptoms of dying that you normally come across?
Yes, of course. I think, it's always really challenging. People are asking me, how do we identify when someone may be dying? And I think there are common symptoms that we will see as people approach the end of life. I think the first thing that we see is that often one of the first signs is people's appetite is likely to be reduced. They often will eat less and less, and then they will often be unable to eat and they will drink less fluid. And that's often quite worrying for families to see. I think we have an innate desire that we show our love and care for someone by feeding them. And so that's always a challenge, I think. But that's one of the signs as the body is shutting down that you cannot take the amount of food and fluid that you used to.
And are you saying that families don't need to worry about that?
Yes, I think obviously fluids, if you don't take fluids, sometimes you get a dry mouth. So we do encourage trying to take sips of fluid for as long as a person is able to swallow. But there will be a point when people will not be able to swallow safely. They may cough. And that may then cause more distress. And in those cases, we would then try and manage keeping their mouth moist by other means. We use things like a little baby toothbrush, dipped in a little bit of water, just to sort of dab the tongue and a bit round the teeth. The bit where, when you wake up first thing in the morning and you sort of put your tongue around your teeth, those are the bits where we feel if our mouth is dry. We also use some gels to try and keep the mouth moist for longer, lip balm on the lips, those sort of things. But it is a natural process of dying that we will stop eating and drinking as time progresses.
Are we assuming that people aren't able to communicate at this point?
Eventually they won't. Sometimes people get very sleepy, so they will have longer periods where they're asleep. So the opportunity to have a drink may be less. So they may sleep for longer periods and they may wake up and have a few sips of water or whatever it is they drink. I'm not really fussed what people drink. It's whatever gives them comfort. But I think it's the opportunity to do it becomes less.
And other signs to look out for?
As I said, people get more sleepy, so often people will sleep for longer. Sometimes their sleep is disrupted, so they may switch about, so they sleep more in the day and less at night, as the body clock is slightly out of sync as time goes on. But they will get more sleepy, and the time that they're awake, it may be harder than to focus on things, so their concentration may reduce. So you may have not the intense conversations that you had earlier in their illness.
And presumably the body is shutting down bit by bit, is it? I mean, can you observe the different organs doing different
things? Yes, so there are different, yes, absolutely. So sometimes one of the things that people notice is the breathing. So as people, this is really in their last days of life, their breathing often changes. So they may, occasionally in their last hours, their breathing may get faster. Sometimes their breathing may get slower and they may have periods where they have sort of pauses between their breaths. But often they will get some slight breathing changes that you will notice. And as they approach the death itself, there may be longer pauses between those breaths as the body is shutting down. Sometimes people get some secretions. Often we think it's actually in the back of the throat where people, as their consciousness is reducing, they're not clearing the normal secretions that we get in our mouth. They're not clearing those like they used to. So it can, even a small amount of secretions can sound a bit gurgly in the back of your throat. A bit like when you've been to the dentist, you can sort of, you hear the secretions there. I don't think the person themselves, it can be distressing to hear it. I don't really think the person themselves really does feel it. I think it's more what we hear rather than the person feeling it deeply themselves. We do give medication that can help reduce those secretions, and also things like repositioning patients can also help, just to help them, the body, clear the secretions in the back of the throat.
So we're getting gradually nearer the end now, aren't we? And I remember being told that probably people can still hear. Mm-hmm. Is hearing one of the last senses to go?
Yes, we think it is one of the last senses to go. So I always encourage people to talk to their loved one. I think our concentration, the loved one's concentration will reduce. So I think they may dip in and out of it. So I imagine it's a bit like when you've got flu, or if you've ever had flu or a serious illness. The important things are you have the people around you, that you hear familiar voices, you know your needs are being met. And I think you zone in and out. So you may zone into a little bit of what's said, and then you may drift off and go back into sort of being drowsy or unconscious. So people may dip in and out. So they won't necessarily hear everything that is said to them, but there may be little bits that they hear. I think the most important thing is they hear a warm, friendly voice, someone that's familiar, whether it be their family, friends, or people that are caring for them, nurses, doctors, people that are familiar, and they know the comfort that you know from people being close by that will look after you.
But that makes it quite difficult for the relatives and the family around the bed, yes, doesn't it? Because you don't know how much they're taking, and you don't know how much you ought to be discussing. I mean, impossible.
Yeah, I think that's really hard. I think you can't be having, I think the person's concentration is not there, so in-depth, long conversations are not necessarily what's important. I know when I've been through it myself, often it's just having someone there. You don't have to talk to them all the time. And have all those, you don't have to have lots of conversations. It's about just being present. It's as important. Sometimes we play music to people. If people have, people vary. You know, I'm quite a quiet person. I don't want lots of noise and chatter around me. And I think if I was dying, I would want quite a lot of peace and quiet. Other people have a real buzz about having noise. And those people might like the radio on, the telly on, those sort of things. And that makes them feel secure. So it's about what's right for that person. And I don't think you have to be watched all the time. I think sometimes we torture ourselves and think that, you know, what happens if they die when we're not there? You know, we've stepped out of the room. You could be there 23 and a half hours of the day, but you still have to go and get a drink. You still have to go to the bathroom. And actually, it's not about being there it's not always the most important thing being there at that moment. Often the moment of death itself is very quiet and not a remarkable process. There is a very slight difference from where they were to where they go. And I think being there that moment isn't, as long as the person is comfortable, settled, secure, it's sometimes, you know, animals sometimes go when it's quiet. You know, pets, my cats, you go somewhere quiet, curl up in peace and quiet. They don't want lots of noise. So I don't think it's the most important thing that you have to be there at that precise moment. What's important is what's gone on before and the time you've spent with them over a longer period of time, rather than that precise moment.
That's really reassuring then, isn't it, for anybody who doesn't happen to catch the moment. Interestingly, we had, that was mentioned in one of our previous podcasts, when somebody was talking about wondering if their father was actually waiting for them all to go before he let go.
And I think definitely people die, it appears, I mean, I've been a nurse for 30 years, and it is more common that people go when it's quiet in general. So I don't know, but often people do go when it's quiet overnight. And I think actually if someone has slipped away unnoticed, then actually they've had a good death, because actually that is a normal death. So I think don't talk to yourself if you're not there. It isn't the most important thing. The important thing is they're loved and cared for. It's absolutely more crucial.
So to summarise what you've said so far, and putting myself in the position of somebody who's actually dying, you're making it sound like it's a very gradual shutting down of various processes that needn't really alarm or frighten us.
Yes, I think for most people that is the case. There is the odd person where it's slightly different and they have a slightly different... some people will become a little bit more restless and agitated, but for the main, it is a slow and peaceful process. Some people will get a bit restless and unsettled. And we can manage that. We use medications and things to try and manage that. Sometimes we give injections, and sometimes we use a pump with medications in that will keep someone more relaxed.
So you're saying they're agitated at the thought of dying, or?
There are a few people that will have some sort of distress around what's happened, but sometimes it's part of the process. So as your organs are shutting down, you sometimes get some biochemical changes in your body, and they can cause something which we call delirium. It is more common in people who have got some impairment. So say someone who's got some sort of mild dementia, people that may have a disease in the brain, so they may have a brain tumour, or they may have secondaries in the brain. We know that those people may be slightly more likely to be restless and unsettled. But we can manage those symptoms. The important thing is when we see it is that we try and do it. And there are simple things we can do as families, you know, having familiar things around, keeping to sort of familiar environment, trying to keep the environment as familiar as possible, not having too much going on at any one time. All of those sort of straightforward things that we would do for anyone who was unsettled and unwell. You know, just like people have a chest infection in hospital, sometimes they get delirious. It's that sort of process that we see.
So tell me more about delirium, Catherine. Is this actually common in someone who's dying?
Yes, delirium is actually. I think they've done some studies, and I think they say over 60% of patients will have some delirium at end of life.
And that could be distressing for people around them, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely. I think pain is the symptom that people most think of, but I think delirium is the symptom that actually causes more distress, because the person may say or do things that is out of character for them. And there's often we try and rationalise it, but there's no necessarily rational explanation for it. As your body is shutting down, if your heart or your lungs, if your lungs or your heart are not working properly, or your kidneys or your liver, or your brain, any of those things will lead you at risk of delirium.
And how does the delirium manifest itself?
So often people will start sometimes by just doing perhaps odd things, saying or doing odd things that are out of character for them. Sometimes they will be more unsettled at night. They often go into what we call the opposite sleep-wake cycle. So they get more unsettled at night, sleep in the day. So they're often early signs. When someone has delirium, we do always look to see if there's a reversible cause. So if you've got a chest infection or a urinary infection, or occasionally some of the drugs we use can sort of cause a little bit of delirium when we first start them. So we always look for reversible causes first and try and treat those. But if there's nothing reversible, then it is more likely that that person is perhaps reaching their last weeks of life.
So it's a symptom for families to look out for?
Yes. And I think it's one that we should pay more heed to as a sign that perhaps things are changing.
And I guess the delirium can be distressing for the person themselves, can it?
Yes, because you feel unsettled, you're slightly out of sorts. And often people have some awareness that they've got delirium. So I often actually ask, so hallucinations is another symptom of delirium. So people will often see black animals, and it varies as to what animals people see. But often I find people won't tell me that they're having hallucinations because they worry that you'll think they've gone mad. But if I directly ask them, are you having hallucinations? Are you seeing things that maybe not there? Often I find that people are having them. And actually, when I reassure them that this is part and parcel of what's happening to them, and it's not that they're going mad, sometimes they find that reassuring. And I can use medication to lessen hallucinations. And I can do simple things like don't hang a coat up on the coat hook by the bed, because when you're tired, and you're getting a little bit delirium, you can see that might be a person. Sometimes people will worry, will think that people are saying things about them, there were conspiracies. And that can be distressing for families and health professionals, because people can be worried or think that someone's trying to poison them. So it's important that we treat delirium, and there are medications we use. So if we treat it, then generally the person is more settled and it is easier then to look after them. Sometimes people can be unsettled and will say or do things that they wouldn't normally say. And I always say that doesn't necessarily mean that person meant it. It's because they've got this delirium. So I think it's important that we try and manage it and keep that person settled. Sometimes people, if they're unsettled, might try and get out of bed, and that might, if they're weak and they're not able to stand, they would be at risk of causing themselves an injury. So it's important that we keep it at bay. We don't want to, the medication that we use, sometimes people worry that this medication may hasten death or that we are sedating a person. We are not trying to do either of those things. We are purely trying to keep them as restful as we can so that they're not at risk of extra distress or harming themselves. But we are definitely not trying to hasten a process. This is about keeping them as settled as you or I would want to be in bed.
So we're talking about some deaths being calm and some deaths involving this delirium.
Yes.
But you can treat it.
Yes, absolutely.
Should we move on now then to the kind of death that people have with pain, the kind of people who've suffering from cancer or whatever?
Yeah, so I think pain is a symptom that people fear the most, I think. And by the nature of the very, I mean, you can get pain from any disease. We always think cancer is the one that causes all the pain, but actually you can get pain if your heart is failing. You can get pain from other chronic conditions that people will die from. Although people really fear it, and often people, most of our patients will be on painkillers as they're approaching end of life. It's not actually the most common symptom that I actually see at end of life. Often we do manage pain. In the main, we manage pain, I should say. And again, we use things like pumps, so that if patients are unable to take their oral pain medication, then we can give it in a pump. So pain can be managed. So actually, as a symptom, I fear that least, because I think it's actually one of the things we can easily control for most people. Sometimes it takes a few days for us to get the balance right. If someone's pain is increasing, we have to adjust their medications. Balancing the medications, you know, because your body is failing, we've got to balance, say, your kidney function and the types of drugs we give you and all of those things. So it can get slightly more complicated, the pain regimes, but we do in the main manage it. It is rare that I see someone dying in agony. That is, I can't tell you the last time I saw that. It is not, that's not the thing that I see.
And you've seen a number of deaths. How many would you say?
Oh, I don't think I could tell you. I mean, a nurse for 30 years and I worked in elderly care community, the hospice here, both in the inpatient and in the community setting. I've seen a lot. So for me, death is a normal process. And I think that's the other thing is, for me, obviously, I see it all the time, but most people don't see it for a long time. I mean, I'd probably been a nurse for 20 years before I saw someone I loved dying. And it is a different experience when you're on that side. So it's not something we're used to seeing. And so our only experience is what we see on TV, what we hear about. And we don't hear about normal deaths. We hear about the ones where things maybe not have gone to plan. So they're not necessarily the normal, but they're the ones we hear about.
And you think that's why we're all afraid of it?
Yes, because it's not something we see and as a routine.
And how do people get it wrong then in films and television?
I think they get it wrong I think it's a more gradual process than people realise. So I think sometimes people expect it. If you're coming into hospice and you're dying, that you will come into the hospice and then the next day you'll die. And that isn't the case often. Sometimes it is, but sometimes people have a slower death and sometimes people find that really hard in that we want to be, in the modern world, we want to be alive and fit and well or dead. We don't like the bit in between. That's the bit we find really difficult. Yeah, so sometimes I think that the timing in films, people are fit and well and then sudden die. And I think that's a bit that's not true to life necessarily. And the fact that we live for a while with illness and not being well and the limitations that come with that and the adjustments we need to make.
So have you seen a number of people for whom death has actually been a release?
Yes. I think some people, you know, when they're reaching the end of life, they just want it to happen and be over. I think people are often fearful in the weeks preceding death, and often as death approaches, they are often less fearful. Some people are more fearful if they've got, and I think that's important where we talk to people about their fears and worries. And I know I've listened to some of your other podcasts actually, and some of the things people have said that are really helpful.
So other changes that you might observe in the body?
So sometimes people's skin colour will change. As the body shuts down, you can sometimes some people will become very pale, or some people, if their liver is not working so well, they may get a bit jaundiced, so they may be a slight yellow tinge to them. Other people, often the peripheral circulation will shut down as people are approaching in their last hours, so they may get more mottled skin, sort of cold hands and feet. So yes, those are some of the things you may see. Obviously the skin is an organ like everything else, so people are more prone to pressure damage as they reach end of life. So we will try and reposition patients and use things like pressure relieving mattresses to try and reduce that risk. I do find that sometimes patients and families are reluctant to want people to be disturbed if they're sleeping, but I do think it's important that we try and balance that with repositioning, because you wouldn't want someone to have a pressure sore at end of life. So we have to try and move people just gently, sort of from one side to another, just to try and relieve the pressure so that the skin doesn't break down.
Presumably, when people come into a hospice, it's understood by everybody that they're dying. But do you sometimes find that families actually can't accept that even when someone's arrived in a hospice?
Yes, I do. I think we all have hope. And I think we all have hope that we're losing someone we love. And we all have hope that perhaps if someone's got it wrong, perhaps this isn't really happening. A bit of denial. It's a useful strategy. When we can't cope with things are too much for us. Denial is a useful strategy. It's not useful when it persists. So I think sometimes people are very hopeful. Sometimes they don't want to lose their loved one. So they try and pretend it's not happening. They try and think of other things that maybe we've missed something. But I think, so sometimes people do sort of, I think they know deep down it's happening, but I think it's that protective mechanism to try and pretend it's not happening now.
I remember when Mike was first admitted to hospital, And bear in mind that he was 94. I was shocked by a phone call the first night from a doctor wanting to talk about do not resuscitate, DNR. Had we got a plan in place? And I, as I say, I was totally shocked because I thought he'd gone into hospital to be made better. Yeah. This hadn't occurred to me that I might need to consider whether he shouldn't be resuscitated. I knew he would be devastated at the thought of not being resuscitated. I kind of brushed aside the whole question and didn't actually answer it in that phone call. But that's a big thing to address when you've got a relation who's possibly near the end of life.
Yes, it is. And I think we do have to have those discussions with either the person or their sort of next of kin on admission to a hospice. And I think it is a difficult topic. I think it's really difficult to know. It's a difficult situation to broach. I think with resuscitation, if your body is shutting down and you are dying, resuscitation is not going to be effective. Resuscitation is mostly effective when something sudden happens to the body that can be reversed. So if I have a car accident, I was fit and well and have a sudden car accident and I've lost a lot of blood and my heart has stopped. If you can restart my heart and replace my blood, I've got a good chance of being successfully resuscitated. If I have a heart attack whilst I'm having surgery and everybody is there and you can restart my heart. If you're dying of cancer or you've got a chronic disease and you're reaching the end of your life, we can't reverse those things. You are not fit and well, and therefore resuscitation is unlikely to be successful. And it's about allowing a natural death, because if we try and do that resuscitation, it is unlikely to be effective, and we are just going to, it's undignified and not a pleasant thing to have happen to your witness when you're just taking, you want a peaceful death. You want to take your last breath peacefully and just, as I said, float off, so to speak. So to have someone jumping up and down on your chest, giving you electric shocks, is not how I would want to die. So I think we have to discuss it, because we are legally bound to have that discussion and have it documented so that everyone knows where we are. And I think often families will feel that we're asking their permission, but it's actually, we've made a medical decision that it is not likely to be successful. And this is more about being open and honest and saying, this is what the medical decision is. And we need to involve the person. And if they're unable to be involved, then their next of kin, so that they're aware that we've done this. But it's not about you as a loved one saying, making that final decision.
So it's obviously a conversation that's very sensitive and that needs to happen at the right time. And in a hospice, it's probably slightly different from in a hospital, isn't it? Because as I said, I was imagining he was going in to be made better. Yeah. And I do think we should probably all be talking about that much earlier on, but then you don't. It's impossible to put yourself into the shoes of someone who's at the point of needing to be resuscitated, isn't it?
It is. I often have the conversation when I first meet people who've been referred to the hospice, because I think you either have it at the beginning of an illness or you end up having it when you're really unwell and we know things are imminent. I think it's important to have these discussions, just like it's important to have your will and for you to know and for your family to know your wishes.
But you'd want to hedge it around with all the things you've just said. Yes. So you'd want to say, if I was in a car accident, say, yes, please. But if I'm dying naturally at the right old age of 102 or something, no, thank you. You'd want that choice.
You would. And so for most of us, that's why we don't have do not resuscitate orders, because we're in that, we're not severely unwell, where death is more likely to happen sooner rather than later. But if you've got a long-term condition, or you've got an illness which we know is life-limiting in months, then I think we should be having those discussions then, so that we don't, it's a difficult conversation to have, and then you can have it and park it and then you can get on with doing it. Often people fear, I think, with having a do not resuscitate form, that that means we won't do anything. And I'm always at pains to say, actually, it is a that is only one aspect of your treatment. That's saying, if your heart stops, we won't restart it. But we can do everything we can to try and stop you getting to that point. So we now do something called a respect form, which incorporates a resuscitation decision, whether someone is for or not for resuscitation. But it also incorporates people's wishes, what you would like to happen, what things you wouldn't want, what's important to you, what you want to happen, what you don't want to happen, and also about how far you would want to be treated. So, for instance, you might have, if I have something, you know, I'm in my last months of life, I wouldn't want to be resuscitated if my heart stops, but if I get a chest infection, I would like to have, and it's likely to be treatable, I would like to be treated. I would like to go to hospital and have IV antibiotics if that's a, if it's treatable. If it's not treatable, if I'm in my last days of life, then I would prefer to be at home or in a hospice and my symptoms controlled and well cared for. So you can have those sort of things on the respect. And I think that's a really important document to talk through with patients and their families so that we all know what that person wants, what's important to them.
And as we're doing now, talking about the actual dying itself is also important, isn't it? Because you've certainly demystified it for me. I hope we've demystified it for other people too. I'm just wondering whether, because you're in this wonderful hospice and there is such fabulous care here, whether you've painted a rather rosy picture of death and dying.
I think I have to be optimistic that this is what we have for most people. I think the biggest, you're right, obviously in the hospice we have good care and support around. When people are at home, it can be, we do have obviously our hospice nurses visiting at home, but there are some things we cannot influence. You know, I cannot get 24-hour care at home. However much I would like to get it for people, it is not available. So it is more stressful. And those people do have to compromise on what is important and what we can do and what how we can best manage in the situation we're in. The same as if you're in an acute, busy ward. It's very difficult to have one-to-one care, for instance. So I guess, that, and there are, some people do have some, you know, there are unexpected events that I can't, for, you know, there will be some events that happen that are out of our control. I guess I don't talk about those because I could tell you all sorts of things, but it's unlikely that they won't happen, and therefore it just creates a lot of fear. Just like I could worry incessantly about driving my car and having a car accident, but if I did that, I wouldn't be able to get in the car and drive. So we have to balance what the risk is and talk about what's most likely to happen and deal with, if something unexpected happens, we deal with it there and then.
But basically you're saying that after your 30 years of experience and having seen lots of deaths dying, it isn't as frightening as we all think.
No, it's not as frightening as we think. I think we can manage death. I think it's important that you have people like hospice, palliative care nurses, district nurses, GP, health professionals involved, because I think they can guide you, because each person's journey will be individual. I am painting a general picture and everyone will have slightly different symptoms. So it's important that you have that around you so that we can help guide you through what symptoms you have and manage those symptoms and support your family in caring for you.
Catherine Gilbert, thank you ever so much. You've helped shed some light on a very dark, normally taboo subject. I'm very grateful.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
We'll be having more chats in future episodes about everything to do with death and dying, such as how to prepare for it, what it's really like when someone dies, how to talk about it, what kind of plans to make, how different cultures and faiths approach dying and bereavement, lots more around grief and loss, how to support others in their sadness, and my personal hobby horse, how to rebuild a life, a good life, after the loss of someone special. If you'd like to join us to talk about the death of someone near to you, if this episode has resonated with you and you have a story to share, or if you've been affected by some of the issues raised, please do get in touch at hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.